It's a glorious April Sunday. It's specifically the 14th of April, and the third week of Easter is about to launch. And Siren Radio and Southside Broadcasting is actually on location for what is, I suppose, technically one of our first major location reports. It's Countryside Links, and we've got two fabulous folk who are with us. First of all, Anna Koshkinel, welcome to your first official audio promenade.
Hi, Alex. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to connect with you. Good. So, of course, you were last here hosting a show for International Women's Day.
Yes, I was about a month and a half ago.
I know. Time passes so quickly. And we've also got, making a debut on the whole thing, from the joys of Huddersfield. It's the awesomely wonderful undergraduate student reading journalism at the University of Lincoln. That would be Marion Hobson. How are you, Marion?
Hi, Alex. I'm good, thank you.
What are your initial thoughts as we've had a little wander here from our car parking area to our base of operations?
Oh, it seems very exciting. There's a lot to that's going to happen. I'm very excited for all this.
And anything in particular you're looking for or looking forward to in terms of giant turtles or wonderful rabbits or any other aspects?
I think all the animals, particularly the rabbits for Anna.
Yeah, well said. We will be working through that. So we'll hear more about that on our usual audio promenade as the day proceeds. And just a reminder, you're listening to the Midweek Drive on location for Southside Broadcasting and, yes, still Siren Radio on April 14th.
Yeah, what we're doing is we're organising the North Midlands area of NAFAS area flower show, which is the first time we've had it here. And it's 10 years since we last had an area show. So it's a very important day for us.
Absolutely. Let's turn to some of our fine correspondents here. Anna, any questions from yourself?
Yes, I was actually curious, since when are you here this morning and how long did it take you to arrange everything here? Because it looks amazing.
Well, we were setting up the actual staging on Friday. Yesterday, all the competitors had between 9:30 and 5:30 to complete everything. And then, obviously, today is show day. So 3 days, and we've been planning this for nearly a year, so it takes a lot of organising.
It definitely takes, and they look amazing, especially the sunflowers there that I see. They're just amazing. And are you nervous for today? What are your expectations?
Well, it is the first time we've had this show here at Countryside Links, and we've been working with the Agricultural Society to put this on. So it's a first for us all. So it is a bit nerve-wracking to see what people think, but I'm thrilled with the quality of all the exhibits. They're absolutely wonderful.
They are, especially the women that has a rose dress, or rose tutu, I think, if I see correctly. And one more question I have for you. So there are lots of events going on outside as well. Are you going to go to them? Are you going to want to do something in particular?
Well, the trouble I've got is that this is my baby with Pauline, who's the show organiser. We've been organising this, so I don't really want to leave it for very long. So I don't think I'm going to see very much other than this.
You can always rely on our audio postcard to give you some of the insights of things that are happening there. So you mentioned the show organiser there, Pauline. Can we have a brief chat, if that's okay?
We'll just, she's disappeared.
Oh, she's vanished.
She's right up the other end of the hall.
That's okay, obviously running away. I mean, clearly, as Anna just said, some amazing sort of signs here that we've actually got, and it does certainly take me back to some of the awesome talents that you've got within NAFAS. I mean, what drew you to flower arranging?
Well, it's a long story, but to cut it short, my wife is chairman of one of the local clubs, and she took over when the club needed to have more members, and I got dragged along just to make the numbers up. And then we trained in floral design, and then I became a demonstrator. So just by me making the numbers up about 5 years ago, I now go all over the country demonstrating. So,
and I have to say, hats off to you, because some of those demonstrations, I'm just blown away by the kind of things. I think both Anna and Marion are too young to remember the Generation Game. You might possibly recall the sort of system where they used to have a flower arranger occasionally on there. It was hopeless. I would be hopeless at it.
Well, sadly, I can remember the Generation Game. Last year at the Lincolnshire Show, I ran the potting shed, and we did have a competition with members of the audience doing flower arranging like the Generation Game used to do it. And the audience always voted for the men to win. So that just tells you something.
It's a very patriarchal society in Lincoln. Anyway, Marion.
Firstly, these amazing flower arrangements, but how much time and effort and work was put into these?
Well, the big thing with any of these floral designs is actually the planning, because the mechanics, as we call them, the structure, is how you start, really, because that has to be sound, because you don't want it to fall over. So that takes a lot of planning, either in your head or actually drawing it out. I'm not an artist, so I tend to think in my head, and then on the day it never works out how you think it's going to. But some of these people plan. I know one lady I was talking to yesterday, it took her a month to make her structure before the day, and then she was all day yesterday putting all the flowers in it. So it's a huge, huge thing. But you don't have to do that. We have novice classes for people who've never won anything before. They're well supported. So you can do something on a smaller scale, because floral art and design or flower arranging, it is for everybody to have a go.
Yeah. Well, as you were just mentioning, for novices, how easy is it to get into flower designing?
Well, the best thing I can say, the best thing is to join one of your local flower clubs, because then all of the people who've been doing it a long time are very supportive of new people, training them up and helping them. So my advice would be, you can come onto our stand today. We've got lists of all the clubs. There's 44 clubs in the Midlands where I'm chairman for, and any of those clubs would be delighted to welcome new members and get them started.
And the ubiquitous web address, is it simply a case of NAFAS into your search engine and you'll find local things coming up?
Yes, that's right. I'm just looking on the banner, which we've got here, brand new design banners that we've got for today, and it's flowersnorthmidlands.co.uk.
Great news. We have actually moved up the ladder, actually, from obviously our first interviewee. He was fantastic, etc. But we're now delighted to speak to
Pauline Foster.
Pauline, of course, you are the... what's your official title with respect to NAFAS? Because I see you've got Ask Me About Flowers proudly emblazoned upon your person. So how do we refer to you?
Right, the reason that I set up this exhibition is that I'm the judge's representative, so that covers all things to do with competition. So I've really been the show manager as well for this. So Andrew, chairman, and I have worked together to set it up.
And as we say, looking at the whole setup, it looks very impressive. Certainly, flower shows in general are also very competitive. So what's been the level of competition this year?
It's very, very keen. Obviously, you can see people are queuing up now, just dying to get in there and see the results. But on the whole, we're a very friendly bunch, and we know each other, and people work together, helped each other to clear up. And Gene, a really, really nice atmosphere.
Now, I think, if I recall, there's an interesting range of judging for the whole thing. It's sort of various ribbons that you've actually got. Can you just go through the kind of the equivalent of sort of gold, silver and bronze in terms of the winners here?
Yes. Well, we have first, second and third in each of the categories of our competitions. So with 13 classes, the judge can decide to do highly commended and commended as well if she chooses. And then on top of that, we've got the extra awards of the most innovative design, best use of colour, best use of garden material, reserve best in show, and of course the big coveted award is the best in show.
The best of the best, really. Yeah. The I Am Maximus, presumably, of the horticultural world. Little grand national reference there. Merrin.
At first I'd say you look very glamorous today.
Oh, thank you.
So what are you most excited about today?
Just seeing everybody's faces when they come in. We've obviously, all the competitors will come back to get the rewards later in the day, but we're looking forward to members of the public that have never been to a flower show to come in and just see how amazing it is.
Well, I'm very excited about it, and I've never seen a flower show before.
No.
But also, have you ever done any flower arranging yourself?
Well, I'm a demonstrator and a judge, and obviously I enter a lot of competitions. So I go all over the country competing. Have been doing that since I was 21 years old.
That's amazing. We were told earlier that it took about 3 days to put everything into place here and to set it all up. And I was wondering, what was the biggest challenge in setting everything up like this?
The biggest challenge was in the planning of it, because as you can see, it's a huge, huge venue. And so I had to write a schedule and decide what the titles of the classes would be. And then depending on the number of exhibitors we got, we then had to start laying out the venue. And that is the most difficult, because you can see that each class has its own kind of structure and its own way of displaying the designs. So really that was the hardest part before we even arrived.
I understand. And one other question would be, what's your favourite piece from here?
Be very difficult to choose, wouldn't it? I am a judge, but I haven't judged today.
And in which case you're in the role of expert commentator who could possibly say, well, personally, if I'd been looking at this, it would have been...
No, judging is a very difficult thing. It's not really a personal thing. It's not about what we like. We judge according to the elements and principles of design. So going round, there'll be some that appeal to some people. Others won't appeal so much. You know, so it's personal choice to the people who are coming in. It's not a personal choice to the judge.
I think at the end of April, it's the North of England Horticultural Society's Spring Flower Show, something we used to cover actually when it was at Harrogate. Haven't actually been to it since it's been at Newby Hall, and likewise the Autumn Flower Show. That is a whole other level. Is that one that you're also looking forward to?
Yes, I usually enter Harrogate personally. I'm actually entering Lincolnshire Show, and my biggest regret is I can't enter today, because it wouldn't look good, would it?
There is that. I mean, and I think you're quite right. You know, I mean, we want to leave such shenanigans to other areas, etc., politicians presumably.
Right.
It's been terrific connecting with you, good self. Good luck with the rest of the day. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. I mean, the effort that you put into it is its own reward in many ways, but we will hopefully speak to you again at the Lincolnshire Show when you've got your own exhibits on.
Yes.
I mean, do we get any sneak peeks as yet in terms of what have you got in mind for the Lincolnshire Show? Is it a case of I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you?
I haven't even begun to think about it. I'm at Malvern Show next month, so I've got to think of that one first, and then Lincolnshire Show.
So. It's the show circuit. It's like COVID never happened, really, isn't it?
It is. I mean, we haven't had one of our area shows for 10 years because of COVID. Yeah. They used to be roughly every 3 years, and so that's partly why people have flocked to enter, because they've been looking forward to us running this. Yeah.
Well, it's been great to connect with you yourself, and once again, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, we've done our behind-the-scenes interviews there now, and we're looking at the definition of an exhibit here. We're looking at one of the exhibits here. Marion, would you like to describe what Easter specialty things we're seeing here?
Yes, so we've seen a range of colours and flowers, so from roses to tulips, yellows, purples, oranges. You even got some animals at the bottom, statues, don't worry, so some sheep, some donkeys, some cows, even a little teacup with flowers in.
Anna.
I'm just mesmerized by the teacup with flowers and the small statues, and by the next exhibit that has a magazine and shows us that flowers can be modern and classic at the same time.
Have you considered actually doing any flower arranging in Romania, Anna?
To be honest, I think when I was about 8 or 9 years old, my mom had me go to some classes with flower arrangements back then. They weren't obviously not nearly enough as pretty as these are, but I think there is just an art altogether.
I'm intrigued by this definition of an exhibit. An exhibit is an individual entry within a class. An exhibit must be contained within the space specified in the show schedule. Natural plant material in all its forms must predominate in all exhibits, and unless otherwise stated, there may be more than one placement in an exhibit. So again, very precise in terms of the rules. It's like VAI for plants.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
Any other favourites that catch your eye, Marion, that you want to have a quick wander over?
Well, there's this one just in front of me, which is like a woman, but there's vines and roses. Is it roses?
Sort of poison ivy, perhaps. Yeah. Let's have a little wander over to have a look at this sequence that we've got at this particular area. And yes, I mean, certainly, obviously, you could almost say a kind of Gaia scenario. Talk us through what we've got here, then.
So we've got the shape of a body or woman, and then there's moss and vines and flowers wrapping around her whole body and to her head, and then at her bottom they all pile.
Anna?
I think it makes you think at one of Salvador Dali's exhibitions when you look at it.
Yeah. Siren Radio continues its audio promenade indoors, actually. We will be making the most of the weather very shortly. In fact, it's still a glorious April day for Countryside Links, and we've been drawn almost magnetically to the people from Take the Biscuit, and they are...
Hello, I'm Tobias, this is Rachel.
I'm Rachel, hello.
Hello Rachel, hello Tobias. Rachel, talk us through what magical things we've got here, and are you quite literally taking the biscuit?
Well, I suppose we are. We make our own shortbread, it's all in different shapes, and the shapes are all matching whatever is on the theme of the tin. So Tobias draws the tins, he illustrates the tins, and I make all the biscuits. So come and have a look and see what shapes you can spot.
Okay, right. Let's do this with our Romanian correspondent here, because I think his score was good for cross. This is where we take the biscuit international, okay?
Absolutely.
So you see what we're doing here. Anna, what sort of things have we got here?
So we have quite a lot of shapes here. We have a star, we have a ball. This is for the seaside ones. Do we have seagulls here?
We haven't got seagulls, no.
Thank the Lord for that, I might say. I mean, they'd have the biscuit in any way. They'd have your biscuit, your chips, everything, basically.
We sacrificed the seagull to make space for the crab, which is what I'm particularly proud of, because it actually looks like it's going to scuttle away.
Yeah. I can see this. Merrin.
Oh, so we've got some farmer animals as well, and then a tractor. So how much time and effort did you put into all this?
Quite a lot. So Tobias draws the pictures. He gets away with doing it only once. And there's 24 biscuits in a tin. So I make all the biscuits. I do it an awful lot. And there's a lot of time spent making these biscuits.
So last Christmas, how many biscuits did you end up making? Was it 24,000?
Something like 24,000 biscuits.
Oh, just 24,000 biscuits. Okay.
By hand, with no help.
And that is why Britain is great, you know, that's the key thing. We might have lousy governments, but at least we've actually got the best biscuit makers in the planet.
I'm very pleased to say that we are selling Lincolnshire shortbread to Scotland now.
This is what I like to hear. Our Edinburgh correspondents will be very impressed with respect to that. This is also a historic day because it's the first official location report for both Merrin and for Anna. So normally there's a sort of welcome in terms of a tasting scenario. Would you offer them a taste of their biscuit scenario? So here we are. Anna's going to taste the biscuit and quite literally popping it in now. And initial thoughts, is there a style for this? Because sometimes a bit like a wine
just
aroma, you need
them,
to...
we're not really standing on ceremony. Just eat the damn things.
So I know it's April, but it reminds me of Christmas, to be honest, and that cozy feeling and homey feeling that you have when you're waiting for Santa with your glass of milk. But can I just go back to saying that when you did 24,000 biscuits, was it only you doing?
Well, I do have help. I have help with the packing of them and the making the dough, but the actual making of the biscuits was me.
So that's not very good advertising for you saying that. But I bet they were amazing. Can I just ask, do you have flavors for each individual tint of biscuits?
All the same recipe. It has won an award, but so the recipe is the same. It's the shapes which are different.
Why mess with perfection? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you know what happened when Coca tried a different form of their routine. The whole company nearly collapsed.
We could do new shortbread, couldn't we? And then release the old one again and make much more money because we call it classic shortbread.
Tobias, obviously you're on the case here. Merrin.
First of all, they taste amazing. It's just like the perfect texture and taste. But also I'd like to say that there's cats here, just for our cats for Siren Radio.
We were mesmerised by them.
Yeah, we do have a midweek drive cat scenario, so obviously we need to obviously be returning for that. How can people actually find you on the various socials? I mean, Anna's busily doing socials, etc., so how can we be tagging you and so on?
So Shortbread Shapes is what to look for on Facebook, on Instagram, and online our website is shortbreadshapes.co.uk.
And have you been to Countryside Links before?
Yes. Probably last year.
There you go. And will you be at the Lincolnshire show?
I suspect so. I'm looking to Rachel now.
We're not actually... Our products will be, hopefully, but we won't be in person. We will be here at the Food and Gift Fair in the end of December.
And we are, obviously, in the season of shows, etc. Clearly, we're on there. So where can people find Take the Biscuit on the road?
So our next show is actually Hampton Court Palace in London. And then we have some smaller ones around here. And then we get really busy towards Christmas, where we are all over the place.
Well, Rachel and Tobias, it's been awesome connecting with your good self today and your biscuits. We haven't taken the biscuit in any way, shape or form, but it is wonderful. And clearly it's going to be a success story I feel it in my bones.
Thank you very much.
Well, as Anna's actually going to continue her ongoing therapy of the giant rabbit routine, thankfully we've come to your pets in any scene. And I have to say, these are quite phenomenal. We've got all sorts of wonderful animals on key rings, but we're delighted to be able to speak to
Lucy Boyd.
Lucy, good to connect with your good soul. So Lucy, what led you, what inspired you to develop this whole range of art styles that suit your pets and so on?
It started from me actually losing one of my pets that was 14 years old. And the style that I do is anthropomorphic, which is a pet in a scene, which dates back to Victorian times when people used to go abroad and come back with stags that are dressed up and to show they'd been to different places. And I'd got a spaniel that I absolutely loved. And he used to dig all the time. So I did a painting of him with a shovel. And from then onwards, when people came to the house, they said, "Oh, I love your, love the artwork. Where did you get it from?" And it went from there.
Here they are. Yeah. Disney, eat your heart out, is all I can say. Merrin.
What type is your favourite, or which one is your favourite?
The favourite and the most popular scenes by far are the hunting and game scenes with the spaniels and the Labradors, because they just suit that scene. Closely followed by the racing car scenes that I do as well.
Yeah. I'm very impressed with the fact that the spaniel is adhering to good health and safety issues. The rifle is indeed cocked. He's not going to actually stumble and accidentally shoot his colleagues.
The funny thing about that, that's my dog Mike, and he's absolutely frightened to death of guns. So it makes me smile when I look at that, because I knew he wouldn't go near a gun.
Kind of irony in there, obviously. Anna.
I was just wondering, how long does it usually take to have an art like this done?
It usually takes me about 3 to 4 weeks, because I build the scenes up and keep those on file. So then I just have to blend the dog's faces into the scene chosen, and then we can actually put more than one pet in a scene. So depending on how bespoke it is, it can take up to about 4 weeks.
And talk about brand extension. We have got keyrings, we have got reusable drinks containers, we have got cards, etc. Is there no limits to the range of which these images can be used?
Nope. Whatever your imagination, we can usually...
And are you a regular at Countryside Links?
No, this is the first year we've done this one, but we do do all the shows. We're doing the Lincoln show later in the year.
I'm sure we'll connect with you at the Lancashire show. But for those people who cannot wait to find out more details about the joys of this particular portraiture, I was just going to say, would you like to just share quite shamelessly the plugs and all the rest of the bits and pieces?
So my company is called Turner & Walker, and we're online at turnerandwalker.co.uk.
We are currently on our first stages of the audio promenade, and we actually have decided to land, quite literally, at a site which says International Bomber Command. And we're speaking to Janine Smithson, Learning Officer, I believe, Janine.
That's right, yes. Good morning.
Excellent. And we've also got the fabulous Leah, also a Learning Officer lead.
Yes. Hello. Morning.
Okay. Janine, let's come to you first. Share with us what you're doing here at Countryside Links and what magical things you're offering.
So today we're here and we're offering glass painting. So we've been invited last year, and because it was so successful and it was really wonderful to see all the families, we've been invited back. And this year we're doing glass painting, so you can make paint your own little tea light holders, or you can paint little glass jars that can be little trinket boxes or something nice and pretty to go on a mantelpiece and give them as gifts. And it's all about recycling. So these are all things that used, and obviously during the wartime, we're from Bomber Command, we deal about wartime issues and the people and the families that were involved. So they would make do and mend with things, and if they wanted to spruce up, brighten up their homes, make them look nicer, then they could just take some old jars and repurpose them.
I mean, this sounds awesome. Marion, any thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, it does seem. It seems amazing. And the glass you've already got up here, it looks great. So what does the International Bomber Command Centre do as a whole?
Well, if you want to...
Leah, you take the lead on this, obviously. So off you go.
So we're part of the learning team. So we have learning, family events, probably around once a month, so some really exciting themes. Our next one is on the 27th of May. We've got an evacuee day with an evacuee competition, so the best dress can win a prize. We also have other events running throughout the year with the events team. Yeah, really fun things, and they're usually free. So,
I mean, proving that she's just an ace learning officer. She's already Jeanine's already sort of passed in a whole range of these things. Anna, any thoughts of yourself?
I was looking at your events program for the spring and summer of this year, and it looks like you're doing quite a lot of things. How long does it usually take to get everything ready, and how do you prepare and bring your things here?
Or do you just rock up on the day and hope for the best?
Sometimes some events need more preparation than others. We actually had yesterday at the centre an Escape the IBCC day, and that was a lot of preparation because we had codes to crack and clues to solve around the centre. So yes, it went very well. We had 244 people attending.
Anybody left there who hasn't escaped us yet, still waiting?
No, they all managed to get out. It's all good.
That's a relief then. And how did you get involved, Jeanine, with the Bomber Command or the International Bomber Command Centre?
Well, a few years ago, there was an advert wanting a learning officer at the time. And so I applied, obviously, and I was very successful. I did have a former colleague that we did a job share for. So I just do part-time. But it's fantastic because I was always interested in learning, and I used to be a freelance teacher as well, going around doing about the history subjects. So this is right up my street, basically. And as soon as I got the job, it was sort of like a planning, wanting to expand Bomber Command's the centre's more purpose of why it is about the people rather than the aircraft of Bomber Command. We obviously have the memorial up there and the spire, and getting those stories out of those people that are named on our walls was very important to remember them, and important for children to learn about their history and the history of Lincolnshire at the same time.
And Leah, similar pathway for yourself?
Yes, so I was a primary school teacher for 5 years and then wanted to move away from it but still do some teaching. So this job is perfect because I get to teach the children about such an important subject and do lots of fun things too.
But Leah, you won't have anywhere near as much admin doing this job as you used to have in primary school work, surely?
Absolutely not. And any admin that we do have, I have more time to do it. So it's all good.
A little dig for the Department of Education there in terms of the amount of admin that teachers actually put under. We don't care anymore. What are you most looking forward to this year, Jeanine?
Oh, it's all our events, because we have such a fantastic programme of things that we do. I always look really forward to our special salute to the 40s. That's when the entire centre, so everybody comes together, and it's usually the second week in August where we take over the entire site. We have reenactors come along, we have vintage vehicles. Myself and Leah will be outside in our pop-up tents with traditional 1940s games, so we have Hooker Duck and Skittles and things like that. And it's just such a wonderful atmosphere, and if the weather is good, like today for example, we do hope to get the Battle of Britain Memorial flight with the Lancaster flying over and saying a nod to us as well, which is really great. So I'm really keen about this year. I'm really excited about it.
Absolutely, we can tell. Something sounds genuinely awesome and well worth accessing. And Leah, best way to actually find out online about the International Bomber Command Centre?
So on our website, and we also are on Lynx Kids and Lincoln Rocks. They also share some of our activities. So,
and just to clarify, Lincoln Rocks is not for geologists who fancy actually sort of saying, oh, have we got some anthracite there? No, it's Lincoln Rocks, as in the music, presumably.
Yes, and I think that Lincoln rocks, but Lincoln's great kind of thing.
Well, would you agree in Huddersfield?
Of course, yes.
And so we continue our audio promenade with a location that has frequently been said you need to do a location report at Heckington Windmill. And I'm also impressed with respect to Heckington Windmill because they don't have any cover whatsoever, so total faith that it's going to be a glorious day here. There's no kind of additional canopy under this. We're speaking to...
I'm Tony from Heckington.
Okay, Tony, delighted to connect with your good self. Now, this is a phenomenal aspect of our Lincolnshire culture, which I suspect both Anna and Marin, and possibly the listener, might be unaware of. So talk us through what is so special about Heckington Windmill.
It's just such an amazing place. So obviously the site was restored, and we now have the interactive visitor centre, the shop, tea rooms, the bakehouse and the brewery all on site available to the public. We do steaming and milling days where our own millers and engineers mill all kinds of flour that we can sell in our shop. And it's just a whole fabulous experience for everyone. And it's so important for generations to be able to see, you know, this farm to fork, how we produce the flour that is an everyday staple.
I'm looking at the wonderful tote bags we've got here, which is Grind to a Halt, Fair to Middling, Rule of Thumb, The Daily Grind, and Keep Your Nose to the Grindstone. As an undergraduate at the University of Lincoln, of course, Maureen, you're used to keeping your nose to the grindstone. Any questions?
Of course, yes. So you've got some activities here. What activities are there for the event?
We have. So we're advertising our education today. We've got a lot of education that goes on. We've got programmes, group visits. So we're doing a colouring competition, turn the 4-cell windmill into an 8-cell, of course, because we're the only 8-cell windmill in Europe. And you basically win free entry for a family of four to the mill.
Sounds great. Anna?
I was looking at everything that you have here, the handbags, the tote bags actually, and the locally handmade eggs. They're just lovely. Did you make those, or did you have your team help you make those, or what's the story behind them?
So we use all local vendors as much as we can, and the actual egg cozies were donated by a visitor. So yeah, we you know, it's just a huge community beacon, the windmill. It's fantastic.
And what brought your good self to the Heckington family then?
Charles and Joe, our trustees, and Mike, of course.
Obviously acknowledging their presence from that point of view. And they've obviously got complete sort of confidence that you're going to work through this today. Your thoughts on Countryside Links? Because I think you've been here before, as far as I recall.
Yes, we came last year and we do all the other shows. We love it. It's nice to sort of spread our wings a bit further, because Heckington's a village that's quite far out. So it's nice to show people that, you know, we're here, come along, we've got a lot to offer.
Well, I think obviously the fates and the universe are conspiring to actually encourage me in the line that Rupert Baker, our actor colleague, who regularly said you should do Heckington Windmill. I think obviously that's getting closer and closer. So what do you say, a location report in sometime in May? Would you say that would be a possibility?
In May, we've actually got our Tuxford book launch on the 11th of May. We've got the Dual Chambers track to run on the 12th. But yes, absolutely.
Looks good for the moment. Huge thanks, and enjoy the rest of the day.
And you, thank you.
It's the range of crafts and skill sets that we see at Countryside Links which consistently amazes us. And we've got a gentleman here who seems to be busily engaged with a little bit of stonemasonry, it would seem.
Yes, certainly do. I'm Ken. I'm a stone carver. I'm from Liverpool. I've trekked across here this morning to show people how we actually do stone carving.
Well, I mean, what could I say? I mean, coming over the Pennines to actually civilise the people of Lincolnshire has to be a good sign in all sorts of ways. Anyway, Maureen, thoughts for yourself?
How much time does it take to sculpt one of these?
How long do you think it takes me to make one of these?
I'm going to say, idea, like more.
Right. To give you some idea, I had 8 of them to make for Blackburn Cathedral, all right? 8 of them. And for people who can't see this, I'm showing them a photograph of one I've made earlier, a bit like Blue Peter, this, isn't it? So the first one took me 9 days, and then I got it down to 6 days. Because as you go along, you think, I'll do it a slightly different way. So you learn by experience almost. So as I say, I got it down to 6 days. So people, I say to people, how long do you think it's going to take? And they're going, a year. I said, well, I had 8 of them to make.
That's 8 years. I mean, it's medieval times, surely.
And then I had other pieces to make. I'm just going to show another photograph now of some other little pieces I had to make as well. So these are the finials off Blackburn that I've made. Well, this is an old one. And then I had to make new pieces there as well. So,
I mean, many sculptors, stone carvers possibly as well, say they see the actual image before they start carving, and they basically just peel away until they actually get the carving there. Is it a totally different system from this?
People say to me, give me a photograph and say, can you carve this? And I can't. You've got to have it in 3D. That's why I have an old piece here. We had an old carve at the cathedral in Liverpool, and he used to make everything out of clay first and then transfer it across. But I'm actually what's called a banker mason, because this table I work off is a banker. So I'm not a monumental mason, I'm not a marble mason, I'm a banker mason that does some carving.
I can see I need to have a chart to actually keep up with this. But anyway, Anna.
I am actually wondering, what happens, for example, if it's not symmetric at the end of the day after you started carving? Or what do you do when something's not working as you thought it will?
I'm just going to show them another piece now. This is another piece off Blackburn Cathedral. And it's a four-sided piece. So if you look at that shape there,
yeah.
You look at that shape there,
yeah.
You look at that shape there, and you look at that shape there.
Yeah.
Every side is slightly different, and it's the case on this finial in front of me. It's a four-sided piece, but if I turned it round, it would be different, and that side of it isn't a mirror image of that side. So probably the first one I made and the last one I made had no resemblance at all. But it's 100 foot up in the air, and as long as it looks right, that's the main thing. It's called a mason's eye. As long as it looks right, you know, within...
It's clearly a craft which many people would say it's a dying craft, but what appeals to your good self about the whole industry?
I say to young people now, you get a craft, train as a joiner, train as a bricklayer, blah, blah. You'll never be out of work. And I say this to people, train as a stonemason. There's not many stone. You will never be out of work. And I've worked all over the world, and I've worked with some of the richest people in the world. And it's an interesting job. The only downside is everything's heavy, everything's dusty, and it can be a bit boring.
But that means so often you get radio people who sort of step up and say, can you do an interview with us? And it takes a moment's piece away. I mean, it's a bit like Jurgen Klopp, he's going to go as well, but, you know, life continues.
Good manager for Liverpool, but I'm a Rangers supporter.
Really? Glasgow?
Yes. Well, yes, but Gerrard went to Glasgow.
And Trevor Stephen, of course.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah.
Graham Souness.
And you know your football, don't you?
Well, you know. Any final thoughts, Maren?
Yes. So, how long have you been doing this for?
I left school on the Thursday at 16 and started at Fountains Abbey. I don't know if you know Fountains Abbey in Yorkshire.
It's a very good place.
On the Monday morning as a naive Liverpudlian thrown among all
in Yorkshire,
broad Yorkshiremen. And I spent 5 years at Fountains Abbey. I came back to Liverpool because I was an indentured apprentice at Fountains Abbey to a mason, and I was just within hitting distance of his newspaper. And if I did anything wrong, he used to hit me with his newspaper. I came back to Liverpool, went on the cathedral as an improver, the Anglican cathedral as an improver. And I say to people, I've been improving ever since, because you don't come to a point where you stop learning. You're constantly learning. A bit like the case of that, the first one took me 9 days. I got it down to 6 days. So it's his a learning curve all the time.
Well, all good, and who knows, Glasgow Rangers might well win the Scottish Premier Division as well if things work out. Well, they're cutting it fine, I think, the last straw. Cuts it fine.
The Hoops are 4 points ahead at the moment, aren't they? So, but a game in hand.
Well, you know, do you go Alan Brazil or Ali McCoys? These are the questions.
Well, I enjoy doing these shows, football aside, and this is my fifth year here.
Fantastic, and I'm astonished we haven't actually spoken to you before, but we have now. And do you do online stuff, or is it going to be ridiculous?
No, I don't do anything like that. Yeah. I don't do any social media at all.
And the world's a better place for it, let's face it.
Well, it is, but I'm the mayor of where I live. I'm the local councillor. So if I go put anything on social media, I get slagged off. So I keep off all that.
Very wise.
Best way. You get a lot of keyboard warriors, don't you?
Sadly, yes. But for the moment, I suppose you could always drop a few of these masonry bits on. No, we won't go there. Well, I'm really pleased to see that the Sheep Show is present at Countryside Links. Normally we catch up with the Sheep Show at the Lincolnshire Show in June, or indeed the Great Yorkshire Show. They're based, of course, in Ipswich, and they're doing an educational side of things in terms of many of the classic sheep that we've got around. Annie, you may be able to recognise the Lincolnshire Longwool, looking a bit like a Rastafarian, who's literally just sort of taking a few steps there, and he's beginning to work through that dance routine.
Yes, apparently Doggle, because that's his name, is quite eager to live. But I was looking at Susie and Belinda. They're just chilling there, waiting for people to, I don't know, come to them, pet them.
Now, if this follows the normal routine, these sheep will all be dancing and performing in a few moments without any hot plates whatsoever. Clearly it's also an educational thing. Ever encountered a sheep show before like this, Maren?
I haven't. I'm very intrigued about some dancing sheep. I've never heard about that before.
Yeah, it just goes to show that sometimes the experiences you have on a location report is quite phenomenal. But it is a very serious point, because obviously what we're getting here is a lot of education about how sheep is actually operated, how they function, and indeed the Massam Sheep Fair, in which we actually have sheep racing, which is very popular up in, I think, the wilds of North Yorkshire.
Never in my life have I heard of this, but I am eager to see all of them dancing and maybe racing, who knows.
290,000 square metres of grass times 40 will make 350 tonnes of dried grass pellets, which will make 2 tonnes of water-soluble chlorophyll. We can only be at the British Chlorophyll Stand, and we're speaking to...
Connor Casey.
And...
Tim Harper.
Okay, Connor and Tim. Connor, let's come to you first. Talk to us about this whole setup that you've got here, and what exactly, because I see It's bringing back my first degree in chemistry here. You've got test tubes, you've got all sorts of marvellous things, test tube holders and such like. So what's going on here?
So we're running a very brief experiment for all the children that are coming up to the stand. It's basically to give them an introduction to what British Chlorophyll do. We are the largest producer of natural chlorophyll in Western Europe. And it's just to give people an introduction, really, and to show what we're doing.
Without chlorophyll, we would not be here, because chlorophyll obviously an essential part of photosynthesis, without which obviously no starch is produced, and the classic C6H12O6 formula. So how important is it to get this educational message across in terms of, you know, how chlorophyll impacts our very existence?
Well, I think it's vital, because, like you said, it is such a significant part of the photosynthesis process. It's an important part of biology, and we need to make sure we get the message across as to how important it is. It's something that we grow here naturally in Lincolnshire with Lincolnshire grown grass. So we think it's really important to come to events like this to really push the message home.
Anna?
I was wondering, with all the kids here, were they excited to see your experiment, or have you started doing them?
Yeah, well, we've been coming to the Countryside Show for a few years now, and it's always been very well received. I think the children like the interactivity of it, being able to mix the chlorophyll and mix with the water and see the results that come out of it.
I mean, you're saying that, but we have two fabulous science enthusiasts here, although one's reading a degree in journalism and the other one's a postgraduate student in business. So can you talk them through what would Murren and Anna have to do now to do this experiment? What sort of things should they be doing?
If we follow the process through, that's the important thing, really, just to get the association with fresh green grass, how we dry that down into a concentrated pellet form, how we mill it and concentrate it, and then how we extract that out, and how we don't waste anything, because we take this extracted material and then remanufacture it as sheep and beef rations, if you like, cow rations, dairy rations. Having borrowed the pigment out of the green pellets, then there's a complex refining process to make two things: pure chlorophyll, which is like an olive green, which you can see in this sort of bottle here. So it's an olive green. And then you go to the more refined side of the green, which is more of a, we would call it a spearmint type green.
Same.
Okay. That essentially comes from two products. So the wax, which is the pure chlorophyll wax. It's talk about grass wax. That is actually a refined grass wax. So it's a solid form at the moment. So that won't...
It's actually solid.
You can't tip that out. Yeah. And then you change this from chlorophyll to chlorophyllin, which is a process. And you can then dry that out. So we take the oils out of it to make a powder form. And that's just refining, further process, sort of second stage of refining, which makes a very concentrated powder. You don't need much of that in a test tube. This is where the children enjoy the bit of an experiment. So you drop a little bit of that in a test tube, like that. And then if you take water to it, you get the right one. We keep filling it up. We should, if we've got this right. I hope we do. Good job it's radio and not TV. So we can get some concentrated green. And we're probably going to need a little bit more in there just to get it done. Dilute it down as opposed to the popular better green. Okay? And essentially that's what they do. You know,
that's classic chemistry.
Yeah, it's just chemistry. They'll put these in mixes with flavourings and then add it into their product. So in the Nestlé's Aero factory, to get that green bubbles inside the bars or inside these balls, exactly what they do. They take a mixture of peppermint flavouring and the green to make that centre.
Extraordinary, and your first chemistry experiment for quite some time, I presume, Anna?
Yes, probably. Do you think, Mary, we should do this in the studio when we're back?
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah.
Extraordinary. How can people actually get in touch with your company? Do you have a web address?
Yes, we do. You just Google British Chlorophyll Company, you'll get it. Or you go through Blankley Estates website. There's links through to it as well.
It's been fantastic connecting with your good self today. Enjoy the rest of the day. And long may British Chlorophyll retain its greenness.
Thank you.
In the background, we're getting the Hans Party Political Broadcast being developed, which is always good. But we've actually arrived at Orion Tree, a family-run, not-for-profit organisation, husband and wife team. And yes, the alpacas are here. Are you an alpaca fan, Anna? Are these going to be your next favourite species to introduce to Romania?
I am so excited to be here. I think I might just take one and, you know, snuck it through the border.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Marin.
There's a very cute, and this, oh, I just, yeah, I agree with Anna. I kind of want to take one home.
Apparently, according to the brand here, the husband and wife team responsible for Orion Tree have set this up by sharing knowledge and bringing the experience of meeting animals up close to people of all ages. We're hopefully going to track down one of these fine exhibitors in a few seconds and maybe have a direct chat with them, all failing that, get a few words with some alpacas. I remind you, you're listening to Siren Radio and Midweek Drive on location at the 2024 Countryside Links event at the Lincolnshire Showground. And as we continue our little walk here and analysis of the alpacas, we see some of the fascinating facts of alpacas. Where do they originate from? Well, camelids first appeared around 45 million years ago during the Middle Eocene in North America. Family apparently remained in North America until about 2 to 3 million years ago when representatives arrived in Asia and South America. And those original camelids disappeared about 10,000 years ago. So, Anna, any thoughts on the alpaca history and geography of alpacas here? That we're looking at in this little gazebo here.
To be honest, I didn't know that alpacas are domesticated animals. I had no idea. And that they come in 22 recognized natural colors, in out of 90% they're white and some grayish color. I had no idea, but it's good that now I know this fact.
I once heard it said that alpacas were people who were too posh for sheep, really. They'd actually go for alpacas, basically. I mean, Marion, any thoughts on the alpaca?
I think they're very interesting. I didn't know anything about Altiplano, I think that's how you say it. So the high plateau lying in the central Andes. And that's where we find alpacas.
Let's just test the actual softness of the alpaca fur here. So do you want to actually feel the difference between sheep fleece in the left-hand side box and alpaca fleece? Anna, do you want to take this little test here that we've got? The sheep fleece is there. And now onto the alpaca fleece.
I think it's softer, that's for sure. And yeah, now I guess we all know why they're called fancy sheep.
Exactly, and indeed there are a whole range of other alpaca workshops that tend to be there. It's a shame we haven't been able to track down any of the folk responsible for this, but I will actually avail myself of one of the cards here in terms of the Kents, etc., who are responsible for Orion Tree alpacas, walking, eventing, and school workshops. It's always good on location reports to connect with people who have already proven to be legendary in previous events that we've done, and we're delighted now to speak to the awesome folk who is...
Martin Keeley from Rutland Willows.
Martin, connected. Wonderful to see you again. Anna here has got a thing about giant rabbits and hares as well, so these boxing hares that we've actually got sculptors here. I don't know, Anna, your thoughts?
I feel like I'm facing my worst fear right now.
So how does she cope with that? Obviously, they are sculptures. They're not alive.
Definitely not alive, no. They are made from willow, and they stand about 1.1 metres tall to the tops of their ears. So they're not going to move too much, and they're not furry. They've got a nice feel to them. So they are friendly. They don't bite. You can stroke one if you want.
They don't bite. They don't scratch. That's great. Normal rabbits should do that as well. But people don't think they're feral just because they have that fluff, you know? And yeah, exactly.
Don't say what's up, duck, when she's around. It's not good at all. Marin.
What is your favourite animal you've created?
So usually the favourite one is the one that I've just done most recently. So I've just made a kudu, which is a South African antelope, and he stands about 8 feet tall, 9 feet tall, with his horns out the top of that. But the one I sell the most of are the hares. So I sell at least a pair a week. So, yeah, they're the ones that that I make the most. The other ones are a bit rarer.
Are they usually put in gardens by people? Okay.
I mean, there could be mascots for countries. There could be all sorts of things here on that basis. Roughly how long does it take you to make one of these delights?
So it all depends on the size of the animal. So my hare's been about their life size, so they're about 7 hours, 8 hours. But the kudu, because of the size of him, he's taken me 10 days. And also it's to do with the amount of willow I'm putting into it. So with these, it's about 140 pieces. So if you made the weave a bit more open, it might only take 100 pieces. So that's a few hours less. So it's all a different thing. I don't
hares for courses, really.
That's definitely true. I'm going to make a pig this afternoon, so I'm hoping that's going to take me about 4 hours, but you never know.
That's true. And how did you get into the whole craft in the first place? I mean, this is just fascinating in terms of what you can do with willow.
It's marriage. I was in the Air Force for 27 years doing electronics, so I know lots about the internal workings of mobile phones. And my father-in-law made willow objects and things from that, and he'd had two heart attacks and just needed a hand carrying things around. Every show, I carried things around, and he got me to make something else, and then something else, and then something else. And so when the Air Force didn't want me, I was straight into it, so it was a ready-made job.
And Countryside Links 2024, your thoughts?
It's been great so far. There's lots of people here. The weather is brilliant. It means people are going to come out. The entertainment's brilliant, so yeah.
And will you be here for the Lincolnshire show in June?
Definitely back for the Lincolnshire show. We're already booked for that one, so we're going to be here in our usual spot.
It's always good to know how to handle a rifle. I know from various Countryside live events in the past, and of course the game show that we used to actually cover with the Daily Telegraph back in the day, shooting is a vital part, and we're delighted to be able to speak now to somebody from the BASC, and their name is?
My name's Ryan Darby.
Ryan, good to connect with your good self. BASC, of course, stands for?
The British Association for Shooting Conservation.
Excellent. Okay, talk to us a bit about shooting conservation, because I'm sure people say, yes, okay, we hear a great deal about shooting, etc., but shooting conservation seems initially to be a contradiction in terms.
Completely the opposite. So you need to have one to have the other. So what we do is we maintain the habitats for the species that live there. So some species live in harmony together, some species don't. So what we want to do is have a sustainable population of all of those species so that, yeah, there's plenty of them. So be it controlling certain predators to help other smaller species to survive, basically. So things like songbirds, so we have to manage our stoats and weasels and other animals like that. With our foxes, so we manage foxes for our grand nesting species, so partridges, which are on the red list, so they're endangered species. By removing them, then we have more of our red listed species, and hopefully they come off the red list and go onto the amber list. So, yeah.
So it's not so much red alert, more caution. Anna?
Well, I do have a couple of questions with no hidden reason at all. Do you offer memberships to people? And in those memberships, is the training included, or do they need to come with a
rifle
license?
Okay, so we are the largest shooting membership organisation in the UK. We have up to 150,000 members. So what we do is we provide training at a discounted price to members. So what we do is we promote best practice all the way through. So how to handle a rifle, how to pass it to somebody safely, make sure it's unloaded when you're crossing an obstacle, so over a river or over a fence. It's making sure it's unloaded, you show it to somebody, you pass it over. And then when you take a shot, make sure it's safe, so there's always a backstop behind it. It's not whizzing into town or anything like that.
Yeah, we were very pleased earlier in the day when we were looking at some of the portrait artists here that when they had their pet portraits, the rifles were uncocked, because that's very critical. You don't want to shoot your favourite pet, after all.
Can you explain a bit about what you've got on display here?
Yeah, so with me today we've got a selection of antlers from the different species. So in the UK we have 6 species of deer, 2 of which are non-native, so they escaped into the UK countryside. Between the pair of them, they populate half of the UK. And then we've got the native species, so we've got our fallow, our red, our seeker and our roe deer.
A little noises off there in terms of as clearly Ryan sort of manages to maintain his cool whilst the display stand collapses, basically. Do you want to take a few moments to set up the stand again?
No, you're fine. Yeah, so we've got our roe are our native deer. They're our nice little family deer. They live in small groups. So what we're doing is I've got the selection out on the table, and the kids are matching the antlers to the deer in the pictures, basically, and then we teach them a little bit about what they do, how they live, and the group sizes that they live in.
Thank you, yeah.
All good. And how did you get involved with the BASC initially, Ryan?
So when I left school, I went to be a gamekeeper. So I studied gamekeeping, so looked after part of an estate down in Norfolk. And from there, I then had the opportunity when the job came up, I applied for it. Several interviews later, I got the job. So, yeah.
And your thoughts on Countryside Links 2024?
Yeah, brilliant. It's really enjoyable. It's great to see so many families here today. It's great to see the Basset Hounds next to us and to see country sports being represented here.
And will you be here for the Lincolnshire Show?
I will indeed be here, yeah. Hopefully I'll have a few more staff here with me and we'll have a bigger stand. But yeah, no, it's going to be great. We're looking forward to it.
Well, hopefully we'll see you then. We'll let you put your stand up now again.
Lovely. Cheers. Thank you.
The joys of the slow-moving and nevertheless long-lived and fabulous tortoise. We are, of course, talking tortoises here and we're delighted to be able to speak to
Adrian.
Adrian, it's great to connect with your good self. I think it's a few years ago you might have done a piece with yourself. And of course, the first quick question that we actually had is, difference between a tortoise and a turtle?
Tortoises are land-based, so they spend all their life on land and just go in water to drink or to wallow. Turtles are water-based, be that river turtles or sea turtles, and would only come ashore to sort of lay eggs. So.
There we are. Anna, over to you.
I was thinking with so many kids, are you afraid they might bite them or are you afraid that the tortoise gets stressed?
They are very, very familiar with people. They enjoy it. I wouldn't bring them out to a show like this if I genuinely felt that they were in any way threatened or pressured. You've got to look at their history to understand why. They're an island species and they've evolved for hundreds of thousands of years on an island without any predation. They've nothing that threatens them in the wild. There's no man lives there and they're not part of the food chain. So in essence, they've evolved without a sense of fear. And they don't come here today fearing people and worried about what's going to happen to them. It's a sense of curiosity. And what's that noise? What's that smell? What's that colour? And that's why they're happy to interact. They also have something called a finching response. And this is something that would happen in the wild where they will stand up with full leg and neck extension. And that will encourage the small birds to come and to preen, basically, to take any ticks or insects or dead skin off the tortoises. And in a way, this is a little bit of a deviation on that theme. They're standing there for the visitors today, allowing them to stroke them and to rub their necks and their legs, etc. And they're getting that sort of stimulation and natural behaviour that they would in the wild. So in essence, I'm not the slightest little bit worried about them from the children. They're very robust. And equally, they're used to being around people. I've never been bitten by them, and I've got 305 years of tortoise experience of the giants.
They're looking very good, actually, for a gentleman in your fourth century. Very impressive. Maren.
How can you tell the difference between a male and a female tortoise?
Technically, really, you need to look on the underside for the clearest definition. The females will have a flat, what they call a plastron, and that's the shell underneath. The boys have a concave plastron, and this is for when they're mating, basically. The boys climb on top of the girls, and that concave element to the shell allows them a little bit more purchase when they're on the back of the female. There's a difference in the tail and the tail length. The boys' tail will be much longer than the girls, but you can't see these sort of things visibly just at a glance. If you put the boys next to the girls, you will see the difference in the muscularity of the neck, the size of the head, the length of the neck. The boys are much, much more rugged and robust than the females. My big lads are not with me today. It's not quite the weather for them. They're at home under their heaters. But when I bring the big ones and compare them to the girls, you will see that they're twice the size of the females. They're much more big.
I never thought Adrian would actually be talking about mating habits of tortoises, but it just goes to show we can go adult if we wish. Anna, any other thoughts?
I was looking, is their shell quite different? Is it different between themselves? Because I see one of those, has really a really big shell, whereas others have smaller shells, not so carved.
I mean, the guys here, there's eight of them with us today at the event. Every time I come out, I bring a different combination of my group. We've got a range of ages here from mid-teens through to mid-30s. So there's a difference in size, there's a difference in development. We've got boys and girls, and like we've just been saying, there is a difference in shell shape and structure. But they're also from different backgrounds. So they're not a group of eggs or hatchlings that I've brought up from you know, one batch. They've got random parents, they're from different backgrounds, come to me at different times from different parts of the world. So their genetics and their DNA are very different, their parentage is different. They've also... been owned by previous people around Europe, So their input of diet and husbandry and upkeep has been very different. So you're going to see very different effects. And it's just like people, you know, these are all the same species, but within that you're going to see different characteristics, different shell shapes, and very individual characters.
We started talking about longevity, and I'm fairly great at saying that, you know, a tortoise is something that literally can last several lifetimes. Is that the case? I mean, how old are these guys?
Absolutely. I mean, the ones that you see here today, these are relative youngsters. They're in their 20s and 30s. In essence, they are capable of the double centuries. I believe the record is 255. So they have a different genetic composition, which is way above me, but I understand that they don't age the same that we do.
255 years is a reasonable lifetime, I think.
It's a good innings, isn't it? It's a good span. So, yeah, I mean, you're certainly in it there for a very different lifespan to humans. What we're going to see now is, as they get older, they won't age. It'll tend to be sort of a disease or an illness or an injury or predation in the wild, maybe something like that, that would kill them rather than aging of years.
We don't want to see them the sort of pass on there. We've got so much to actually offer from that point of view. Marianne, any other questions?
How much does a tortoise like this weigh?
Weigh in terms of... as I sit here today, most of my guys are around the sort of 11, 12, 13 stone mark. The bigger girls over there, you're looking around sort of 18, 19, 20 stone. My big lads at home, you're looking around sort of 34, 35, 36 stone. And that will increase.
Samurai tortoises, basically.
Yes. In the wild, the boys can potentially get between quarter of a ton and a third of a ton. So they are a real unit.
And we're in the show season now, of course. Will you be going around to the various circuits with respect to tortoises on the road?
I do take them out to some events over the summer. It's a chance for education. It's a chance for people to meet them. And also we do have to do some fundraising to get them through the winter. They eat a lot. They need keeping warm, etc. So there is the practicalities. I'm not a circus. I'm not about attending every event. It's quality rather than quantity. But yes, they will be out at events over the summer across the UK.
Adrian's been fantastic sharing with her good self some of the insights into tortoises. Do you have a website?
I don't, I'm afraid. I keep it very private. These are my personal pets, so I'm not a business. I'm not banging my drum or anything. It's just a chance for people to meet them outside of a zoo environment and to almost kind of do a mini keeper experience, just very briefly.
Well, Adrian's been fantastic connecting with your good self. May your continued tortoise success continue ever onwards.
Thank you very much, and we maybe see you again next year.